Hey, thanks for letting me use the comic book store as part of the scavenger hunt.
Oh, my pleasure. Always happy to help out with fun things that I wasn't invited to be a part of.
This is the Extra Extra Hawkray Podcast, Episode 76, Listener Forcing, The Big Bang Theory. I am lonely comic book guy David T. Cole, and I'm here with Princeton gag Sarah D. Bunting.
I don't get it.
And hot, hot Neil Diamond hit Tara Ariano.
Ba, ba, ba.
I have one piece of site business for Extra Extra Hot Grape before we get into this episode, which is somebody corrected me in my use of robot versus android in our last one.
I saw that.
So, yeah, all androids are robots. Not necessarily robots or androids.
I believe that listener also corrected you about Daleks, that Daleks are not robots.
Oh, yeah, right, that too. I don't care about that one. But the android the android robot thing, I knew, but I don't know why I phrased it like that. But I just meant I didn't want any, like, people robots walking around.
Fair enough. Yeah. Thank you to all of our eagle-eared listeners.
Yes.
All of you out in Patreon land.
Especially you, robot guy.
Thank you for your support. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you especially to Sharon Johnson, who has suggested our topic, and she wrote, I would like to suggest the Big Bang Theory episode, The Scavenger Vortex, which, in case you want to watch it, listeners, it is season 7, episode 3. It's on HBO Max now. Sharon writes, while I'm aware that it's not well thought of among the EHG family, BBT is one of my all-time favorite television shows, and this is one of my all-time favorite episodes, so I hope you'll give it a look-see and maybe come around to it a little bit. Well, give it a look-see. We did. Here is the premise of the episode. Raj is disappointed that nobody came to his murder mystery dinner party, and so to punish them, I guess, he has put together a scavenger hunt for three teams of two. So the teams end up shaking out as Penny and Sheldon, Bridget and Leonard, and Amy and Howard. Because originally the idea is that, you know, it'll just be all the couples will be together. And then Leonard is not sure he wants to do that. And Penny assumes it's because he thinks that she's too dumb to be good at this. There is also in the process a lot of ribbing about whose college scavenger hunt were the hardest, because there's, you know, a lot of a lot of territoriality between who went to MIT or Harvard or Princeton. Apparently, Leonard, having graduated from Princeton, is at the bottom of the totem pole. We'll let Sarah respond to that as our own.
Not seeing a lie so far.
Our own resident Princeton dunderhead.
You talking to me? Also, dunderhead. When are we?
Anyway, it's obvious why Sharon would pick this one, you know, since Game Time is one of our favorite segments on Extra Hot Grate. You know, the competition element is very winning. So let's discuss it. I'll just say before we get into it, I was quite charmed by this episode. I'd never seen a full episode of The Big Bang Theory before. And, you know, it's true. She's right. This is not generally my jam. But I get why she picked it, and I thought it was cute. Sarah, what did you think?
I think I had seen maybe another full episode. My notes do say, quote, so Bernadette equals Tara. Got it.
Oh, Bernadette, not Bridget. Yes, thank you.
No problem. She does look and sound like a Bridget. This is one of those shows that it's like, even though it's not for me, I completely understand that it is like there's something about the predictability of the build and the jokes that I understand why it's very soothing. It does zag a couple of times when you think it's going to zig, but not usually. Mm. There are other things about it that are sort of like, this is just like kind of relentlessly middle of the road and pretty white and like, that's not great, but like for what it is, this is something that I would have taught in my class, mm-hmm. honestly. Like, not that this is groundbreaking, but this is like very sitcom-y in every sense of that, good and bad.
Yes.
That, you know, the predictability is the point.
Right.
And the way it's written, acted, and just like overall executed to hit those beats exactly right. Whether you think that's great or not, it's done in that like predictable off the shelf fashion. And I respect the workmanship, basically. Do I need to watch this again? No. Was this a diverting enough 21 minutes? Yeah.
Yeah, it was very turkey to me. I didn't really care for it.
That's
too
the
much.
Word I want. Thank you.
Let me just say for everybody listening, jigsaw puzzles, 100% not fun. If you're into jigsaw puzzles, you really got to look at yourself and think, where did I go wrong?
Wow. Shots fired.
They are. They're just like, it's like I would go up to a kid. I get this like, here's a nice little drawing. I'm going to rip the page up into pieces, throw it on the floor and say, put it back together.
That's a Why don't you just put it in a frame and give it as an anniversary present?
Oh my God.
Tara would love that.
Sarah. Okay. Sidebar. We're currently recording the Again With This, or the rather the 90210 book that Sarah and I wrote. We're recording the audio book of it. And I just read my chapter on that episode of 90210, which if you don't know, that's what happens. Brenda and Brandon buy their parents for their anniversary, their wedding photo as a jigsaw. And it's like for all these stupid reasons, like the worst present, and reading it aloud, like the contempt that I have for it, it will definitely be audible. Anyway, back to this episode. I agree. It's super sitcom-y for sure. But I thought there were a couple of cute moments. I do think, you know, it's evident even not having ever watched this episode that the comedy in this one comes from two of these team pairings being people that do not spend time with each other. In one case, that goes very badly. That's Leonard and Bernadette, not Bridget, as I correctly said up top. In one case, that goes great, and that's Amy and Howard. Dave, please play clip one.
To the planetarium!
Let's go!
To the tar pits!
Let's go!
There's a Neil Diamond concert next month.
Let's go!
So they end up in the car together. They have nothing in common. They finally figure out after he gives her his phone or his iPod or whatever to like put on some music. They figure out the one thing that they have in common is they both love Neil Diamond. So every time they cut back to the two of them in the car, they're just like rocking out to Neil Diamond. It's predictable. And yet the two of them, it's like it's completely it's not the writing. It's just the performance that puts it over because the two of them are quite winning in those moments, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. Well, and those that's the callback and that you like, okay, which song is it going to be this time? Like, I get it. Like, I get the appeal of this and I respect the build of this, even though it's like, but I can see the build of this.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. The tension that arises between Penny and Sheldon, which is the third team, clearly grows out of their familiarity with each other because they spend a lot of time together. And you know, she knows all of his personality quirks, shall we say, starting with the puzzle where he wants to build the whole thing, even though they, as soon as they figure out it's the comic book store and that's where they're supposed to go, she wants to go, but he insists on putting the entire puzzle together first and makes her crazy. And he's trying to anticipate everything that they could possibly need. And so he's like got a bag with a bunch of random stuff, including a bowling ball. And then clip two.
Oh, it's a bowling alley.
Yes. My brain is better than everybody's.
Which, like, yes, am I Bernadette in this episode who's like so competitive Howard doesn't want to play with her? Maybe. But am I also Sheldon? Kind of, even though at the end he's just like he doesn't really care about winning. He's more interested in like he appreciates the effort that Raj has put into all of this and just thinks it's like kind of interesting and doesn't really care when it turns out everyone had the coin that they were always looking for all along. He like slipped it into all of their pockets. There wasn't anything they were actually competing for. And obviously everyone is pissed and, you know, they're all furious and they are right. Raj should at the very least get a wedgie. This is a bit, a betrayal. Dave, as a game master, you would never.
I would never. I mean, at the end of the day, if you say something like, well, the coins were the friends we made along the way, like, I would punch you in the face. Exactly. Like, that's not what game time's about. Game time's about making enemies in the moment.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. The guy who plays Howard.
Yeah.
He looks like Nick Cage's mini-me.
Uh-huh.
There is a very Nick Cage facial energy he's got going on.
Well, I can tell you, he was on Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip playing one of the actors, and that was one of the impressions that he did on that show. And it was pretty good, I have to say, actually.
Yeah. I like Jim Parsons. He's good.
Yeah, he's funny.
Yeah. I mean, I understand why he's the breakout star.
Mm-hmm. So I would say my ruling on this is I don't necessarily see myself seeking out the Big Bang Theory while I'm at home and, you know, I have all of my choices available. But it's, you know, if I'm ever in a hotel again in my life and it came on, I wouldn't be mad, you know.
I didn't hate it, but it didn't change my mind about the Big Bang Theory. And I feel like this episode actually, like, from what I hear anyways, I mean, I can't speak it directly, but from what I hear, it's sort of like this episode doesn't have those sort of point at the nerd tendencies that this show is known for.
Sure. And
that would bother me watching that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm not defender of the nerd. I just don't find that that funny.
Yeah. Yes.
The reason I actually couldn't get into the IT or the IT crowd in the UK, like I just, that just didn't click with me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's some, you know, maybe not the best, like, sort of iterating on manliness humor.
Yes.
It's like, I mean, I don't think if this were, you know, if this episode came out today that you would have some of this stuff. But yeah, I'm sort of where Dave is. Like, this was a pleasant 21, 22 minutes, and it didn't change my mind. But the thing is, I've always kind of felt about Big Bang Theory that it's just one of those shows that's like, some people want to watch TV that lets them escape from life versus reflecting it or unpacking it in some way, and this is perfectly turned material of that type. More for other people.
Also, get rid of those transitions, they're so bad. And they kill the moment. They're amazingly bad idea. Anyways, goodbye.
And now let's take a look at Benjamin Matlock, the attorney who handled the case for the defense. Terry?
For the last 30 years, Ben Matlock has lived and practiced law in Atlanta, Georgia, where he's well known for both his high prices and the high percentage of clients he successfully defends.
Ben Matlock's office.
Like a spa, your mouth is like a fireplace with all ashes out. Well, all ashes out, boys, with all ashes
just a minute.
Out. Your mouth is like a fireplace
Ben?
With all ashes out. Well, won't you?
Ben?
Won't you, I say, grab your
Ben?
Hand, Miss Lucy. What?
This is the Extra Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 83, Dave Makes Everyone Watch Matlock. I am the one Hollywood restaurant, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Wedding Tape, Sarah D. Bunting.
Chicken Dance of Death.
And Sketchy D-Girl, Tara Ariano.
I wasn't going to run you over.
The DVD was ordered. It arrived. We have all watched the Matlock episode I threatened to make everybody watch. And here I am following up on that threat. I even forget in what context it arrived to our attention. It was
the essential Jason Bateman, Sarah's last topic.
Oh, so this is my fault now. I see.
It is. So to refresh your memories, we were talking about this Matlock episode, and it was described something like there is a murder that involves somebody at a studio, at a television network. And through that process, there is a bunch of testimonials from all the stars of NBC come out to shine with their testimonies about so-and-so and blah, 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 blah. And sure enough, that is what this episode is. It is a little murder mystery involving TV people and then all the late 80s stars of all your favorite NBC programming come out to give in-universe testimony for Entertainment Tonight style show called Entertainment Today, which is like, wow.
Lazy.
Yeah. So I'm going to assume everybody listening is familiar with Matlock. I don't have to explain the premise old Atlanta lawyer.
Folksy LLP.
Columbo-y, you know, unassuming. And then he's got you because he's so smart. And he plays the banjo a lot, apparently. Do we need to go through the plot? It doesn't really matter, right?
No. You know,
I've already almost pretty much said it. There's a murder. One studio guy seems like he was probably set up for it. Who did it? Probably somebody else in the system. Spoiler, yes, it was. The presentation of the whole episode is kind of a segment of Entertainment Today in which they sort of magically show you scenes. It kind of dips in and out of it, but they don't really do transitions well. So they're kind of like almost presenting it as if this show has like Eye of God knowledge and footage of everything, which is interesting and poorly thought out. But the other thing they do is they have all these talking heads from NBC properties talk about this guy who's on trial. And they include, here's the rundown. We've got Betty White, Corbin Bernson.
Bernson,
thank you. Jason Bateman, from his Valerie's Family days.
Yes.
To place it in historical Valerie spectrum context.
Yes.
Yeah.
Rhea Perlman. Malcolm Jamal Warner. And then most puzzlingly at the very end of the episode, Alf. So before we get into that, I just want to say, like, outside of the show, I was like, oh man, we're in such trouble because the credits starts and these might be the worst produced credits of a TV
my
show.
God.
So cheap. So cheap and so poorly done. So the first signifier that you're in trouble is, do you know what, if I say posterization, do you know what I mean? It's sort of like when you take a high fidelity photograph and you reduce that photograph to like seven colors or something. Like if you think about how GIFs looked like on the internet in the early days, can you use 16 colors to get it small enough as you want it? That's posterization. They do that every time the action freezes during the credits. And it looks so bad. It looked bad in the day. It looked bad now. I don't understand why they did that, because it is inherently sort of a computery effect, and that's like such a disconnect from the homespun, you know, hometown wisdom of Matlock. It's just like a weird choice. And then they have these moments in the credits where there is supposed to be like a character cutout on one half of the screen, not like like contour cutout, like around their nose,
like
and
a
their
baseball
hair.
Card. Yeah.
And then like scenes of them in the other half, and I don't know who was cutting these out. First of all, the cutouts are extremely low resolution compared to everything else.
With like kindergarten scissors.
Yeah. And when I say low resolution, keep in mind that this show was like 280 or something like that. Like this is like way back when. So these are probably like somebody did it in Photoshop and it was at 72 DPI, and they forgot that isn't high resolution enough for the rest of the work they were doing. It looks all like pixelated. No. Yeah, somehow like they printed it out of a dot matrix printer. It's just so bad, and the edges don't make sense. Sometimes they're crisp, sometimes they're all fuzzy,
and there's like trailing colors. Yeah. Sometimes like cheap tabloids still, like the Inquirer, are still printed that way, where there's just like a trailing edge of cyan that you're like, oh, guys.
I was just surprised how bad they were. Like, I wasn't expecting like something super great, but I was just surprised. And another thing.
And it's like inconsistently bad, like you said, like the talking heads with the in-universe NBC cavalcade of whatevers are like, barely, like I've started to feel a little migrainy because they're just not, it's like not at the same resolution as the show.
Ugh. Right. Yeah. The show seems like it was maybe shot on film or at least has a different grade. And then like, obviously the word was put out to the set director and all these shows. When you have a minute between takes, get these guys, throw them in the room and made them read this. And like, it has that sort of planning and urgency to it.
Yeah, monitor footage.
Yeah, calling in some favors in the NBC network. And the last thing I want to say about the credits is there's a disc. I think Matlock would disapprove of the all lowercase credits. I think Matlock would be a stickler.
Yes,
for
you're right.
Proper casing.
Yep.
I don't understand that choice. That's the episode in a nutshell. we don't really care about the case. It's a whatever. Mm-hmm. We're here to talk about all the weird NBC shoehorns. So, Tara, let's start with you. What did you find surprising about these? What did you find dumb? Like, what were your overall impressions of, like, how they did it?
Okay, well, first, I would be remiss if I didn't know, because Sarah would have clocked her also. Our friend Anne Gillespie playing a director of development, a pre-Jackie Taylor Anne Gillespie guest stars as a non-NBC talking head, and looking so different with her hair past her ears. She looks so pretty.
Yeah. Yeah, she looked great. I was disappointed that it didn't turn out that she did it. Spoiler.
I was too. That's where I thought it was going. I was kind of bummed.
Oh, yeah. I got one more thing before we get into that, because I talk about the 80s-ness of it. I clipped a little bit of this of the soundtrack when they start revealing in the courtroom who the murderer is, and it's such a moment in time.
You're, oh, okay.
Here's 13 seconds of that.
No further questions. No.
That's it.
And then Vincent Price leaps out from behind the judge's chamber's door. Oh, God.
All right. Well, in terms of the cameos, I did think it was a little funny that all of the cameos were like, it's all like these are all, you know, backhanded compliments of these stars of NBC, you know, basically describing that this guy who died was a scumbag they all hated, which was like, did not seem of a piece with Matlock. No. You know, like,
and also the tone was different from the rest of the show.
For sure. Yeah. And so Betty White is up first, as you said, and she's like, you know, he always had the personal touch. He made sure to call me personally when my show was canceled, and I never forgot. It's like, okay, bitch, like, I see you. And Corbin Burnson says something like, you know, everyone else will stab you in the back. Well, until he came around and he, you know, now people stab you in the front and what a blah, blah, blah. Yeah. The Malcolm Jamal Warner one was kind of funny because he refers to advice that Mr. Cosby gave him about, like, don't do anything for free, because when you do, next thing you know, they're going to be having you on the set, you know, basically doing exactly what he's doing, like, ha-ha. So, like, these were... Yeah. And so these, they were, like, it was just much more winky and, like, inside baseball-y than I would have expected, A, Matlock to be, and B, Matlock to expect its viewers to, understand.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that was, it was, like, very witty. But then on the other hand, I was like, well, I guess people who are watching Matlock already think that Hollywood is a cesspool run by degenerates anyway. So, like, maybe this is what they were expecting. I don't know. But the part of the case was very perfunctory. Like, it just seemed like it turned on, you know, one guy calling Matlock and being like, oh, he wasn't where he said he is. And that was the break in the case. Like, it's so half-assed what actually ends up, you know, revealing who the real killer is.
Yeah.
That plus, like, oh, and then we got this video and we zoomed in on this. It's like, no, you didn't. That would be like, it would look like if you stood really close to Asura and, like, in that scene in Ferris Bueller, that's what you would see if you zoomed in the 1980s. Yeah. Matlock. Yeah. But fine. this was cute. It was very cute. That was my feeling about it. And I actually thought all of the cameoers were, like, they were fine and they were good sports to do it. Sarah, what did you think?
Yeah, I agree. Alf, as usual, was like, oh, right. Bitch, bye. Like, I'm glad you were at the end. I almost, like, stopped the recording and I was like, oh, it's you. Cat eater. I did think that for what it was, like, it looked like shit, but I thought all these stars were pretty game. And Baby Bateman in particular made me think of two things. Like, just the way he was seated on the couch was like this very sort of like, Robert Evans, like, he had his hand clasped over his knee and he's being sort of like expansive and mm-hmm. telling the story. And I was like, that sort of contrasts with his occasional, like, cutting his eyes to the camera on Arrested Development. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was very funny. Like, this is a guy who understands that this is part of his job. Mm-hmm. And it also made me think, Dan and I started watching The Boys finally a couple nights ago. And it just reminded me of, watching, what's her name? Starlight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doing the endless promos, like, stay tuned, WKMU. And then just that she gets 2 seconds in between and her face just falls. And it reminds me of, watching that. We found that reel. I don't know if you remember this, of like Anthony Edwards just reeling off a string of CTV promos for like 20 minutes and we became hypnotized by it on YouTube.
Yeah.
It just reminded me of that. And like, I definitely remember thinking what you said, like, for 1987 and on Matlock, this is like such a Trojan horse, like meta shitting on Hollywood thing to put on this show at this time. But also, you know, I have seen a legal procedural before. So the actual case was sort of like, who cares? I was just like looking at the fashions and being like, yeah, that still looks good. Gillespie looks cute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we going to go back to those Wonder Woman belts with the in the bright colors? Like, yeah. So it was fine. I was really expecting, based on the credits, for an extremely trying 48 minutes. And also, oh my God, thank God there's more commercials. Sorry about it, but it's true. Shows should not have been 48 minutes long or 46. Like, keep it to a tight 40-30, please. Yeah. Thank you.
There's a point where we, like, Matlock gets on he's standing in a hallway, like at the video production place, and like he gets the phone and we see him make a whole phone call. Like, why? Just show him go to the next place he's going.
Was long enough that I was like, all right, as much as I appreciate being returned to the halcyon days of 7-digit dialing, there's absolutely no reason for us to watch this. Like, it's like Eric Deggan said that one time, that he's like, you'll notice how much time you spend watching people driving up switchback driveways in old TV shows.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like when we watched that Columbo for the game.
Oh yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God.
I have to admit, when I first read the description way back when we did the Jason Bateman one, and having watched it now, I was a little disappointed, because in my mind, it was like they were all integrated into the show. In my mind,
that's what I was picturing too.
It was sort of like the end of Pee-wee's Big Adventure when he goes through Warner and like everything. There's like, oh, there's Godzilla here, and there's Twisted Sister. I thought it would be like that.
Mm-hmm. Where
they're kind of like, it was sort of a family circus walkabout the studio, and then like it's all the stars.
I was
going to
go with Ferris Bueller running through the backyards, but yes,
kind of, yeah. But it was okay. And obviously, you know, how else are they going to do it? Get all these people in on one episode, you know, without creating chaos and whatnot. All right. But what we're really here to talk about is the end, after everything happens. And this is just sort of like just before the credits, the last scene of the episode is the testimonial from Elf.
Greg really cared about the quality of his shows, and he had a temper. I remember one time he was so upset with a script, he started pounding it on the wall, tearing it up, yelling. An alien life form wouldn't say that. So I calmly asked him, Greg, do you want to help us rewrite this script, or would you rather take it back to your office and slap it around a little? He didn't laugh.
It is a part of the Entertainment Today show. It is Elf as a person given equal weight to Betty White and Malcolm Jamal Warner at all. There is no hint of a hand going up his ass, that there is an actual puppeteer here. He talks with Elf dead executive direct relationships and that relationship to the show. So I think within the Matlock universe, via Entertainment Today, Alf actually is an alien in this world who has a sort of autobiographical show, sitcom, based on his experiences. I don't know how else to interpret the way they present Alf within the confines of Entertainment Today within Matlock. Mm-hmm. Am I crazy? Discard the fact that it's a funny lark. I'm talking like we live in the age of the MCU now where everything has to be connected. Everything has to be canon. You're now not allowed any flights of fancy. Everything you do must be somehow entered and make sense into your universe Bible. Elf is a real thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that's a correct interpretation.
Mm-hmm. So like the next episode of Matlock is just like everybody losing their shit because there is like an alien on TV and it's like proof of life and all religion is bullshit and the nukes fly. Is that basically the next episode?
Yeah.
And then David Duchovny shows up with a ponytail. I was hoping that would happen.
We've got frozen yogurt, jelly yogurt, and chocolatey eclairs.
All the necessities of life can be gotten there.
Easy in, easy out, rich man or poor.
Everybody's equal at convenience stores.
Come escape. And bring a day.
This is the Extra Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 85, co-host Forcening Shangri-La Plaza. I am abandoned third-party cell phone repair store, David T. Cole. And I'm here with giant fiberglass donut, Sarah D. Bunting.
Fresh.
And future vape store owner, Tara Ariano.
I'm coming for you, former video stores. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our latest Patreon bonus episode. Thank you so very much to all of you for your support. For that, we are rewarding you with this discussion of an extremely weird episode of TV. In 1990, CBS took a flyer on Shangri-La Plaza, a fully sung-through musical sitcom set at a Los Angeles strip mall. It didn't work, but Michael Darling's article in Los Angeles Magazine, Shangri-La Plaza, the star-studded all-musical sitcom Time Forgot, made me curious enough to assign it to my co-hosts. That is what we are here to discuss today. So the story came up in my feed when it was originally published in August. It's so good and comprehensive, I don't really need to recap it in terms of the history of how the show and the pilot came to be. The link is in the show notes. You should just all go and read it. The full pilot is also embedded in the article as well. So let's start the discussion here. Last night, I texted our friend, past and future guest, Adam Grossworth, who did a marathon diary of cop rock with Sarah, to send him the article and let him know that this discussion was coming up in case he wanted to get a jump on watching the show. And I noted that it was the same year as Cop Rock and asked, what was in the water in Los Angeles in 1990? Cocaine. And then he sent the article to another friend who asked the same question using that same phrase, though that friend did not guess cocaine. So I have another theory about why these weird shows all happened at once. But Sarah, you watched Cop Rock with some intensity. What is your theory about the confluence of these events, or do you have one?
I don't have one.
Okay.
There was also, did you mention Hull High?
No.
Because that also was 1990.
Oh,
that was
God.
The NBC
wow.
offering.
Okay.
Would you like me to deliver my verdict on this since I'm the cop rockologist right here?
Well, how does it compare to Cop Rock? Sure, let's start there.
I am interested to hear what you guys thought of it and to talk this through and also to hear from my fellow prisoner of Cop Rock War, Adam Grossworth, about this. But this is, to me, miles more charming and successful than Cop Rock, and I'm not exactly sure why. Mm. Like, maybe it was because it was only, whatever, 22 minutes. Mm-hmm. Maybe because it wasn't, like, I never heard of it before. it was an episode, so it's not like it was a legendary flop. There are things wrong with it. The floating credits heads are super creepy. Like, even for 1990, the technology was better than that. And yeah, everyone was better than Chris Sarandon's, whatever that is, offensive accent as the landlord. Mm-hmm. You can't not talk about Allison Mack as the little kid, because there she is being a little kid. Uh-huh. But she's good. Like, I don't know what it is about this. I think it's maybe that it's way less self-serious. Like, it deliberately set the stakes really low, so like you don't, like, it's not off-putting in its own self-regard. Mm-hmm. One of the first shots is a Mercedes-Benz convertible from the era, so bunnip. Sure. Mm-hmm. And then the 8-year-old schools the mechanics on how to fix something about it, which I thought was cute. But there's also like a thing that Adam and I kept coming back to in our Cop Rock coverage is like, why does this feel so much like everything I hate about musicals? And he would always say, like, the thing about the musical that like everyone sort of consuming it has to agree on is that the reason people are singing instead of just talking to each other is that they have no choice. Mm-hmm. There is like a compelling reason that this must be expressed in song and or dance. So when you have a production that's like some talking and then everyone stops and does a number, that's different from a sung through thing like this, where almost every single line, including exchanges like sorry and no problem, mm-hmm, which like I wrote down as one that I thought was funny. It's just different because there's a complete commitment to this like completely unrealistic atmosphere. Like, the surreality is, everybody's bought into it. I think the music is also just better. Like, the, oh, wow. The donut song with the waitress and Allison Mack, I thought was pretty good for this. Mm-hmm. The timing of the cast seems a lot better. Like, they seem to have cast properly with people that, like, you have to cast people who actually can sing and have some timing, which Cop Rock did not always seem to understand. Mm-hmm. what it was doing. And I think the boss's wife is not in this production, which helps. But for whatever reason, like, there are things wrong with it. I can't imagine, like, I can't conceive of how this would have gone on for a season.
Yeah.
But there is something like between the low stakes, the utter commitment, the I think just superior, and like, again, it's a low bar, but just the superior performances, and like it's just better and it works better. And I think it really does come down to self-seriousness. Like, everybody was just like, well, like, we sold this, fuck it, let's see what happens, versus Cop Rock, which was like, who's gonna say no to Botchko? I guess nobody. Well, here we go.
Right.
So, but yeah, like, I would buy this album.
Wow.
I thought it was cute. I don't know. Maybe holy, I'm really moly, tired or dehydrated. I don't know. Yeah, I liked it.
Wow. I mean, my best theory as to why all of these like very weird projects were happening at once, and Adam's friend pointed out, like, every time I hear about some weird pilot, it's always 1990. And the other example was one that has come up either in one of our game times or a USA quiz show game time, which is Puchinsky, where Peter Boyle is a cop who dies and gets reincarnated as a bulldog.
Uh-huh.
And I forget who. Oh, it's not Futterman. It's the guy who was Charlie from Scandal is his partner. That young cutie, okay, who was like the husband from Father, the groom from Father of the Bride, that guy.
Yes. George someone?
Yeah, George Newbern, thank you, is his partner. And that was another one that was a 1990 pilot. And, you know, as I said, some of these are cocaine decisions for sure. But my best guess is that, like, this is when Fox was really starting to be a thing. Like, it had started in 1986, but this was the year where it was like The Simpsons was about to go head to head with The Cosby Show. Like, it was enough of a hit by then. Also, like, In Living Color had premiered and it was a huge hit. Like, this was pre 90210, but that was about to be a big hit. Like, I think other networks were like, we have to try to do some big swings in order to compete with this new network that is just like does not give a fuck.
You also just have that in like, you just wonder if like things don't linger from pitch meetings. Like, you had Chicago Hope and ER starting at the same time. Like, sometimes it's just a thing that happens. This is notably weird because there were three of them and it's a musical.
Yeah. Yeah.
They all are notorious for, well, this one isn't notorious at all. I never heard of it, but the other two are.
Right. Well, because they actually went. I mean, this one aired one time and then that was it.
Yeah.
Dave, your thoughts before we get into the specifics of this episode, as it is?
Well, I guess the one thing that we haven't set up is that the strip mall, and it's shot at a strip mall, but they dressed it like all in pink and it's all like kind of Pee Wee's Playhouse-y because it apparently shares the same visual director or whatever, you know, whatever that title is.
Production designer.
Yeah, yep. Production designer.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird. It's also kind of weird because there's a donut shop right next to an auto body shop somehow in this strip mall.
Yeah. Which a strip mall would never have an auto body shop. Like,
not a full strip mall. Like, I could imagine like a Winchell's in the middle of nowhere right next to, you know, and next door there was a car place, but not in the same, like the strip mall is like those, you know, LA, like there would be a fish taco place and, you know, a couple lawyers and then, like, you know, it's not
a nail shop.
Yeah. And they just decided that they're going to have mechanics for whatever reason. And they're like, yeah, sure. Throw the auto body shop in the mix with the restaurants and whatnot.
Right. But like in the theme song, they talk about how easy in, easy out parking is a feature of strip malls. Like, and then they plop this auto body shop, like right in the front of it. Like, even if you would say a strip mall might have an auto body shop, it would be like in some weird annex around the back. It would not be right in the front where it is. Like, logically, just doesn't make sense.
Right. Anyway. Like that creepy barber shop, you know, it's always in the alley and that
old wall. Hancock? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Alley stores.
Totally. But yes. Okay. So the story of the episode, such as it is, we have the Bondo brothers, the mechanics, who are named George and Ira, which is cute. I didn't clock that at the time that we were watching.
Oh, I just figured that out.
Those are the names of the Gershwins, Dave, who are composers.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dave.
I was just going to say one of them reminds me of Genesis guitarist from the prog rock era, Steve Hackett. And I just want to say, I'm curious. If anybody's answer to this is yes, please just like hit me on Twitter so I know. Mm-hmm. But I was considering getting all the Steve Hackett Genesis song titles and seeing how many I could incorporate into this discussion. Uh-huh. Like, you know, that Pee Wee's Playhouse set design, it looked like a big job. I'm sure there's a little blood on the rooftops after that. And I was going to try to fit about 10 in. Uh-huh. If that would be amusing to you, you would know what the fuck I was actually talking about. Hit me on Twitter. I would appreciate just knowing that somebody would have appreciated it.
He's played by Terrence Mann, who I first hit where I know him best from is he played Bob Ballard, the marine biologist, in that episode of 30 Rock with the first Chloe Grace Moretz one. But he is a Broadway guy.
Your description of he's a sort of like Hugh Laurie.
Busted Hugh Laurie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stretched out a little bit. Yeah.
Sarah, you had another comparison for him, though.
He's like David Coverdale and Michael Bolton.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. He's got a little Curtis Armstrong from Revenge of the Nerds energy about him,
yes.
too.
Yes.
All these things are appropriate as a description for this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So his brother is played by Jeff, I think Yeager is his name, and he is best known to me as the guy who played Elaine's boyfriend, John Germain, on Seinfeld, the one who would not go down on her. And then he did, and he was a saxophone player. And then I guess he was like so bad at it that it fucked up his embouchure and he like ruins a showcase. Spoiler for that episode. So they are the mechanics. Then there's Amy and Jenny, mother and daughter. They are played by Melora Hardin and the aforementioned Allison Mack. Melora Hardin, of course, would go on to be Jan on The Office, but around this time, she was also playing Baby in the TV adaptation of Dirty Dancing. She has had quite a career, Ms. Melora Hart.
Yeah.
Of course, now we know her on The Bold Type. But yeah, she's the mom. So she's inherited this donut shop from her dead husband, who previous to dying left the family, and she's not that psyched about it, and the place does not seem like it is going great. And her plan is to sell it and then go move to France and study at the Cordon Bleu. But at the end of the episode, she finds out she has no assets because he had hawked it to the gills. And actually, she owes money. So she's going to have to stay and try and make a go of it. And that's good news for the brothers because they both have a crush on her. And then there's also Savion Glover and a couple of other kids do, like, they dance around and there's sort of a Greek chorus to the action. And apparently he had, like, hurt his ankle or his foot right before shooting started. So they have to incorporate a lot of crutch choreography, which I think they do pretty well, considering. It's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, given that they had no choice.
Yeah. And as Sarah mentioned, Chris Sarandon is also there as the landlord doing an offensive accent, which has not aged well. And yeah, that's it. And so the stores, we are already mentioned, the auto shop, the donut shop. There's also a video store, which is very of the time. And then there's a gag through all of this, all of the shops in this strip mall, that they all have signs out that say, "We sell frozen yogurt," including the mechanics. The mechanics has a spinning sign that says, "Tune-ups on one side, yogurt on the other," which, after I noticed it, I turned to Dave and was like, oh, that's good. It's funny that all of these places would be competing against each other at this time with this product. If this were being filmed now, it would be CBD. That's the sign that I always see in, like, lesser strip malls.
Oh my God, absolutely.
Or vape capsules or pods or whatever the hell they're called. And 15 years ago, Dave was like, what did you say? Cell phone, aftermarket cell phone repair. Totally. That's another strip mall store. Or before that, phone cards, long distance phone cards were what I was
seeing. True.
Yeah. It's funny to me that, Sarah, that you thought the songs were great, because I went to clip some and I thought, like, none of them were that memorable other than the theme song.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, you know, I'm not saying I'm correct. I'm just saying, like, compared to Cop Rock, where they were ultra memorable because they were completely, like, over the top, tone deaf, and terrible. Like, the Baby Merchant song still haunts my fucking nightmares.
Wow.
These were just, like, little sprightly things, and they didn't go on for 4.5 minutes. It was, right, like, 90 seconds? That's enough. Like, they're just singing a, you know, sprung duet about how they both want to bone the new donut shop lady. There's not that much to that. We're done. And then there's a little bit of business at the front door, and it's cute.
Yeah.
It's not actually Gershwin, but it's good enough.
It's cute. It's inoffensive. You definitely watching it can tell why it didn't work. Like, you can see, as you said, it's unimaginable how they could have sustained this for a season. Like, how you could have written a season's worth of songs.
Well, first of all, the little kid would have died throwing donuts into a fryer.
She throws it so aggressively.
It's like throwing a fucking pitch. First pitch out in MLB game.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was
that spatters, Allison Mack. You're going to learn about burning later in life, but
they put icing on the donuts, and that's not the way you put icing on donuts. You don't squeeze it out of a cake decoration thing. There's a whole way to do it, and it's just like, you know, those buffet buckets, you know, that sit just on top of warm hot water. Like, that's, you have all the icing in there, and you just dip the donut in. That's
the way to do. The donut verisimilitude did not meet the high personal standards of former donut baker David T. Cole.
Quite. Barely.
But even all of that said, and, you know, it certainly does not hold up to scrutiny against something like, you know, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, obviously.
No.
But even all that said, the whole cast goofing with a group dance in the closing credits, like, it almost caught me on board. Like, that was so cute. That was like a little bit winning.
I mean, you could see how it got out of the pitch meeting.
Yeah.
That even though they were like, they said yes. Like, you can see if that was the energy in the room.
Yeah.
That people would be like, okay.
Yeah. And like, it's, you know, it's at essence, like, a workplace comedy. And it's just like, our workplace is this strip mall. You know how strip malls are a thing right now? let's make a show at a strip mall. Like, okay, I don't know. Sure, why not? You know, and it's a musical. Oh, double gimmick. Okay, you know, let's give it a shot, I guess.
Oh, it's summertime. Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, it was an interesting thing. It was a great curio for Michael Darling to have unearthed and written an article about, which you also should listen to. And I'm glad that we all watched it. And now we have it in our minds forever.